Hi, everyone. This is your co-host, Stu, and I am here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Stu. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for asking. Thanks.
So today I was thinking we would just kind of have a conversation, talk a little bit about ghost hunting. And I mean, that's a subject that I spend more time on than anything, and I don't talk as much about it. I thought today might be a fun time to do that and share some stories.
All right. And I'd like to take this opportunity to ask people, if they haven't subscribed already, please click the subscribe button down below. Click the bell so you get to be notified when we release all of our content. We have a couple of Facebook groups, the Paranormalist Podcast, and also the Paranormalist Group Share. We have an email address, which we're still fishing for cues for Q&As. That's at paranormalist@theparanormalistpodcast.com. And I think actually Mrs. Stu may have a couple questions for us.
Awesome. Mm-hmm.
So, we can get started. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I was, most people, a lot of the people know, but some of them don't, that I come from a ghost hunting background. I wrote my first book, Haunted Pennsylvania. There's now two different versions of Haunted Pennsylvania. And people started writing in to me and asking questions, you know, telling me stories, sharing their experiences. And a few of them asked for help. And that's really where I started with the ghost hunting. And I have to tell you, it was back before there were any TV shows on the subject or anything like that. I'm getting to be an old chick. So, you know, really, where do you go for this? So I started reaching out to different people I knew and had heard about and learning a little bit about the paranormal. And I have to tell you, it has changed immensely. So the basics of ghost hunting have changed from the very beginning. So what I learned at the beginning is that people never went to places to ghost hunt. Ghost hunting became a tourist experience, but only from like the 1990s upward. So the first people who ghost hunted, going back into Harry Price in the late 1800s, like they went to the sites only because they wanted to have an experience where it happened, but they didn't have to stay at the site. They used Ouija boards, which I'm not a fan of, and they could call spirits into them. When we started doing EVP, there was a lady by the name of Phyllis Estep. She is the mother, if you will, of American EVP. And she would sit in her house and do it. And she would just, you know, start recording. There's a really famous story about how she actually got her very first EVP. So she had heard about it. She had seen it. She wasn't exactly interested in the paranormal, but it was an interesting experiment. So she decided to designate 5 days. And if in 5 days she could not get any EVP, she would just quit and go on to whatever the next thing was down the pike. So she had this great big reel-to-reel that was back in the days of those great big reel-to-reel recorders. So every day she would sit for an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening, and she would just say the same thing over and over again. And she would, you know, hello, this is Phyllis, or is there anybody out there? Will somebody come talk to me? And she'd pause. And she did this for an hour. On about the third or fourth day, she was getting really bored. And so she finally said, all right, so what is it like where you're at? And that's whenever this entire phenomenon became born, because it was an answer. And the answer was beauty.
Oh, wow.
And once she heard it, she was hooked. Now, there had been a few people doing recordings. The first recordings were accidental previously, but this was a deliberate attempt to communicate with the other side and to communicate in a way that was recordable. You know, up until then, there had been the spiritualist movement with the Ouija board and the automatic writing. And all of that you can debunk. And whether it's true or not, and I'm not saying I don't believe any of it, but whether it's true or it's not is really subjective, because how do you know that the person isn't deliberately moving their hand? How do you know that the voice isn't some hokum? You know, and spiritualism was fraught with fraud. So that doesn't lend credibility to the subject as a whole. Now here, suddenly, there is something that's discernible that you can do in your own home, that you can do anywhere, and people can watch you do it. They can bring their own equipment now to do it, and it's legitimate. And I have to tell you, even with the advent of all the gadgets and gadgets that have now come out for ghost hunters to play with, There is nothing that is more convincing to me than a solid EVP. I have led so many groups for tours and what have you, and we've taught paranormal research in so many places, all the way from Ryan Research Center to doing it here locally in my area. And when you see a person come in with a recorder that is their recorder, whether it was the old little mini micro, you know, spool thing, this cassette, or it's one of the newer ones, and they're standing there holding this thing in their hand, and you're doing an EVP session, and somebody asks a question, and when they play it back, they've got a voice. They have this look of childlike wonder in their eyes, because it's theirs. They did it. Nobody faked it. They know beyond a shadow of a doubt, they didn't put anything on that recorder, somehow wind it back, do something. And that's what makes, I think, that one of the most compelling pieces of evidence. So as a ghost hunter, it's something I really find fascinating. I will probably always find it fascinating. And I've had so many experiences that have come out of that. One of my most favorite is in the old Altoona Railroaders Memorial Museum. We did a lot of paranormal research back in the day in that building. It had some amazing stories. So basically the gist of it is that it was the old Master Mechanics building, just to give everybody an idea. So it's a huge building. It's four stories high. And it's actually one of the smaller buildings from the PRR, believe it or not. And it survived whenever they tore down a whole bunch of the other buildings. They decided to turn it into a museum. They, you know, redid everything, modernized it, and then put the exhibits in. There was a gentleman by the name of Mr. McNitt who was the original curator, and he began to have experiences. And then the staff, as the staff came in and settled in, began to have experiences. And it was interesting because nobody wanted to be the person to say it. So for quite a long time, for a couple years actually, this stuff was happening and nobody was talking. And then one day at a staff meeting, one of the newer employees was raised her hand and said, "I just have a question. Has anybody here ever had a strange experience?" And I remember talking to Mr. McNitt, and he said, it was just like somebody had shot a gun. Everything went off. And everybody was like, "Oh, let me tell you what happened to me." And he's like, it was a round robin in the room. Everybody at the table had stuff happen. So it was a very active building, and they allowed us to come in. And we've had footsteps walking past us. We've heard voices talking to us. But there's this really amazing one. It's an EVP of music. It's like we're at the end of an evening, we're on the fourth floor, which was the most active floor, and I had a recorder I had borrowed from somebody else, and I was watching these two shadow figures in the distance moving back and forth in the half light from the lights outside. And I said to him, you know what that is? And he's like, yeah. And I said I pissed him off, because I've been agitating at him on purpose. And I'm talking and all of this, and all of a sudden you hear this music swelling up behind it, and it's very clear, sing, sing, sing with a swing, the original version, which we would later find out. And it plays for a couple, almost a minute and a half probably, and it fades out as we're walking away. And so it's really interesting. And it was fascinating, because when I played the music for Mr. McNitt, he said to me, "Oh my God, you caught it." And I'm like, "I caught what?" And he's like, "Any of the staff that comes in on a Sunday to like work on a project or to, you know, help put a display up, they will, if they're here by themselves on the fourth floor, we've had repeated reports of somebody hearing a radio playing, old time, you know, 1940s kind of music." And he's like, "I've heard it at least twice." And I, at first, it was right as the workroom was still there. And he said, "I thought somebody forgot a radio and it was in the wall." And, oh. You know, I mean, that was his first thought, was, did somebody leave something running? Did somebody, you know, one of the workmen leave a radio in the wall? And it was just fascinating. So we actually caught it. I could actually probably send that to you. You could probably put that in if you want.
That would be interesting to superimpose that in here. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be, it would be, it's really clear.
Elevator. You guys are taking the stairs.
See it moving?
Yeah.
You know why it's moving?
Because it's pissed.
Do you know why it's pissed?
Because you asked it the hard question.
Yes, it did.
Hold on. Yeah.
So it's a good one. And so I just, you know, that's my favorite part of ghost hunting. I've seen lots of things. I've heard lots of things, but that's subjective. So audio and video are the two things that are the least subjective. Now, they're still necessary to weed out other things like shadows walking by and, you know, lighting issues and stuff like that. But they still give you a component. Like if you can isolate that area and you can isolate what was going on and who was in that area, it's a pretty good idea if it's a legitimate EVP or not. So that's one of the reasons when we teach the ghost hunting, we talk about, you know, you have to stay in your area. You have to make sure that there's a person who's monitoring exactly where everybody's at. Like when we're on a site, everybody reports in about every 20 minutes. And there's, you better stay where they're supposed to be if they have to leave for some reason. So say something's really going on the third floor and, you know, Joe radios out and says, hey, I need some of the backup up here. I see there's a lot of stuff going on. I could have used some assistance. Immediately, so-and-so is going to come on and say, Patty, I'm going up to help him. And I'll know who it is and that they're in transit. So if we catch footsteps on a camera going past that area or an area he's going to pass through, but we don't see the person, immediately I can shoot that down and say, no, wait a second. That was just about the time you would have been walking through there to go upstairs to help so-and-so. And, you know, now ghost hunting is on TV and it's, I have to say, it's kind of hokey at times.
Oh, I stopped watching pretty much all of them because... Yeah. At first, you know, they captured your imagination, you know, as they do. But then we need ratings. Because if you remember, and I'm not going to say the name of the show, at the beginning, the plumbers would investigate the sites. And you know, they would say, yeah, we don't really see any hauntings here. And maybe their ratings were slipping or something. I don't know. But all of a sudden, then it just became every time. At first, they reluctantly said, yeah, there's some activity here, but we don't necessarily know if it's haunted, to seeing, yep, it's haunted. almost every single time. Yeah.
Well, I honestly believe it was probably developed that way so that they could build the suspense for the drama impact of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, like all, whenever they started seeing stuff every time, people weren't going to say, well, they always have since the very first episode. So they, you know, established their street cred that they're going to not do that and then moved it forward. That's my humble opinion based upon what I've seen over the years from these kinds of shows. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that some of the places they visit aren't seriously haunted. I'm not saying they don't actually get some stuff. And I also want to say that the production companies put a lot of money into this. So they put a lot of pressure on people. You know, you have only X number of days on a site and you better produce something. And so the gadgets are a really good way to
add, keep it up.
Yeah, to add drama to it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's that one that they use where the thing's dancing. You'll see that little stick figure moving around.
Oh,
and
yes.
I don't know what it's called anymore.
The different points, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've never had a scientific explanation to explain to me why I should believe that little stick figure's a ghost. Never.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the, almost everything, if not all of the equipment for paranormal investigating was never built for that. You know, maybe the Ovilus was originally built for that, to speak to the dead. But beyond that, most of the equipment was built for something else. EMF meters were for finding wires.
Right.
For electricians. And all we were looking for was electromagnetic fields that weren't stagnant. We knew there were fields in walls. They would stay there where they're supposed to be. If you have a lamp in a certain spot, the EMF field's going to stay around it. We know there's two types of EMF. There's the electronic type, and then which is artificially created, and then there's the biological type. There's something called a tri-field meter. You can set it to only pick up the biological type. That means, though, that a person two rooms away, if you're in certain conditions can still interact with that meter and set off a false positive. So you have to be, again, very cautious that mm-hmm. you know who is where. And but there, I've seen some great results with it. We've been in spots where the Railroaders Museum being one of them, we were sitting in an area, everybody was behind, back at the doorway. The machine was not clicking. It does this like, you know, and click, and you'll see the little needle go. And the faster and the louder it goes, the closer the EMF field is to the meter. And we used it to elicit answers. So if we wanted a yes or a no answer, it would step close. If it was a, you know, no, could you step further away and make it stop working? Well, it's not, of course, 100% conclusive, but it's very suggestive whenever you ask five or six questions and then you repeat the question to get the same pattern, you know. So, yeah, is this a gentleman who's in the room? And it steps back. Oh, this is a woman. Am I correct? And it steps forward, you know. So at least you get a physical response. I've seen things picked up and moved. We were at a prison, an old empty prison in Cambria County, and one of our tripods with a video recorder on it was picked up and turned about 180 degrees in front of three of our staff who actually had another camera and mm-hmm. caught it lifting up and doing that. So, you know, I still like the more tangible things. I'm not big into that. And even though I have a little bit of a spidey sense of my own, that cannot be the only thing that we work from. I need to know the history of a structure. I want to know that whatever they're telling me that they're seeing makes sense within the confines of what the history of the building is. So, for example, we did a site, and there was a woman who was killed in the building, and it was a public building. And it was interesting because there really was nobody knew about this woman being killed in the building. It was something that we actually took weeks and weeks and weeks to find out. Oh. And they were seeing it. They were seeing this woman walk through this building, and nobody could explain it. So when we go back and we look into the historical record, we find that, yes, on this site, in this building, while it was being constructed, this woman was killed in an accident. And then we find a description of her, and then we find a photograph of her. And having already talked to them and had the people that have had the experience give us a description, and how tall was she heavy, was she thin, was she dark-haired, was she light-haired, you know, what kind of clothing was she wearing? Can you help me pick a period of time based on the clothing? And it matched. And since they didn't see the photograph first, that takes the suggestibility out of it.
Sure.
So those are some of the things that, you know, that as a ghost hunter you look for. And I think the ghost hunting shows are kind of dying out because they've gotten too hokey. They've kind of worn people out.
To use the Happy Days term, they jump the shark.
Yeah, I mean, it's, mm-hmm. I think people are always going to be fascinated with the paranormal. They're always going to like a ghost story. They like the hands-on stuff. And paranormal tourism is something that's here to stay. It just is. And so is something called dark tourism, which is like going to murder sites and stuff like that. And the two overlap. Mm-hmm. But it's just really fascinating. I personally like the stories where it's something that happens to you inadvertently. And one of the times that's happened to me is I did a lot of speaking in libraries when I first started out after the first couple books. So we were invited to a library in Blair County. And I'm standing in this little town's library. I'm talking. There's another person with me. And so I sat down so that person could tell their part of the stories we were telling. And as I'm sitting there, I'm watching this shadow moving in the ranks of books, thinking there's going to be a person popping out on the other side, right? Mm-hmm. But nothing happens. So I kind of lean over to kind of get a better perspective. And the curtain starts tugging, because this is right by the wall. And this curtain by the window starts tugging itself. I'm watching that, and I'm like, how is that happening? How is that happening? I keep my mouth shut. I'm just observing. And I'm not thinking, oh, this place is haunted. I had never heard such a thing, and I'd been there before. So I'm just keeping an eye on it, and it's one of those things, I'll mention it later, kind of a thing. And
so you don't have everybody turning around and looking all at the same time.
Well, yeah. And first of all, it would have been rude to interfere with the other person speaking by going, look, the curtain's tagging, you know? Mm-hmm. And then second of all, I'm not sure what's going on. So I want to play it out and see where we go with this thing. And when everything's all done, and I had seen four books like tip over one by one, just like somebody took their finger and went one, two, three, four, one at a time. So I'm watching all of this, making my notes and what have you in my head. When it's all over and everybody's gone, I've signed the books, everything's done. I say to the lady that runs the library, I said, this is really an interesting event tonight. And she's like, oh, I thought so too. It was wonderful. I said, but I have a question. And then I proceeded to explain to her what I saw. And she grinned at me and said, just a minute, walked to the top of the stairs. We were on the second floor. And she yelled down and she said, Ellen, could you come up here? So this older lady comes up and she says, tell her what you just told me. So I tell her, and Ellen's eyes are literally dancing with mirth. And I said, what's going on? And she said, oh, you met our ghost. And I said, your ghost? I didn't know this place was haunted. And she's like, yes, yes. So back in the 1940s, at the back of the second floor of the library, there used to be a door. And it had a set of stairs that went downstairs. And the second floor was actually a music hall. So people would rent it and they would have dances on a Saturday night. So like the local Elks Club would rent it, and the such and such social group would rent it. And there was a young gentleman who was there, and I guess he was a lot more inebriated than he should have been. And he fell down the stairs and passed away.
Oh, okay. Well, so, ghost stories start with a death at some point. Yeah.
Yeah, they do. They all have to have that, and they have that in common. Well, unless you're seeing living people, which is rare, but it happens. And, you know, I had never heard this story, but this older lady, she's got this little clipping book, and she goes and gets it, and she's like, this is from the newspaper from the night it happened. This is from the newspaper from, you know, she's like showing all this stuff, and I'm like, okay. And she's like, and every so often he plays pranks on us. She's like, he's just very funny. He'll put a bunch of books on a table for like the kids, and they'll all be fanned out real pretty, and the library's not open, and you come in and they're all swept off onto the floor, you know, or something like that. And she's like, we used to talk to him a lot. We've kind of gotten away from that. And I'm like, well, I can only tell you that this is what I saw, and he must still be here. Mm-hmm.
Was this a library that you had patronized previously, or were you there for the first time for this book signing?
This would have been like my third or fourth time in this library. It's there's a little town in Blair County, PA called Claysburg, and it's the Claysburg Library. Mm-hmm. It's just a little library, but it's very nice. The people are awesome, and I've really enjoyed, you know, speaking there over the years. And I was like my third or fourth visit there.
Mm. And that's like, well, midway between you and me.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. It is. And, you know, I've had those kind of experiences. One of my funniest ones was there's a place in Gettysburg called Her Tavern and Public House. And it is an amazing place. I highly recommend it. It's got a B&B in it. It was used as a field hospital during the Battle of Gettysburg. There's a ton of ghost stories attached to the building, right? And I went down after my very first, I think it was during my first book, while I was getting ready to finish my first book. And I wanted to put a story about this place in. And I had called ahead to be able to talk to the owner and made an appointment. And I got there and I was a few minutes early, which I was grateful for, because I needed to use the restroom. It's a long drive, 2-hour drive. So I go into the bathroom in the dining area. And I use the restroom, and they have these stalls with these hooks, hook and eyes, you know, that you lash the hook into the eye. Yeah. And should be perfectly easy, right? So I go to unhook it, and it won't move. I mean, it won't move. And I'm pulling on it. I'm pushing it. I don't want to break it, but I'm trying desperately to get out. And I'm like, this thing's not budging. It's like it was welded shut. And my options were to ignominiously climb underneath the stall door and get out, or pound on it and yell, help. So I was like at that point of, I was in there a good 10 or 15 minutes. I'm thinking I'm going to be late. He's going to think I left. It's going to sound crazy. So I'm desperately trying to figure this out. And I'm like, okay, you're just going to have to get on your hands and knees and shinny underneath there. That's all there is. Thank goodness I was younger, because now I don't think I'd try it. And just as I do that, I'm like, okay, fine. I yell out to the ether, because there's nobody in the room with me that I could see. You're going to make me have to crawl out of here. What a rotten thing to do to somebody. And the latch lifts itself up, flips off the eye, and the door swings open.
Yeah, I've had similar experiences to that, where I actually do an exclamation, like, well, many times in my house, I get touched. Mm-hmm. And I say, would you please not do that when I'm in a situation where you're going to startle me? Otherwise, I don't mind. You know, and I'm not saying my house is haunted, but I mean, there are situations where, I mean, I've had my belt tugged up from the back when I was standing at the sink. That's tough to not notice, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to detract from your story there. But
yeah. Oh, not at all. I love listening to your stories as well. Mm-hmm. And but anyhow, it was just, you know, very odd moment. And so I go out there. I get my composure back, go out, talk to the gentleman, hear all the ghost stories and stuff. And at the very end, just as I'm getting ready to leave, I kind of turn around and I go, because I've been debating in my head about this. Do I really want to say this, you know? Because I don't want to be that person who comes to hear a ghost story and collect the history. And then, oh, I saw dead people. You know, I don't want to be her. And I was a lot worse about that at the beginning than I am today. Like today, I would probably just say it out loud you're not going to believe what just happened to me. But back then I was afraid to. And I turned back around to this gentleman and I said, I just have to ask you, has anybody ever had anything odd happen in the bathroom? And he says, why? And I said, well, I had the door stick. I couldn't get it open. And he's like the latch wouldn't come up. And I'm like, yeah, the hook wouldn't come up out of the eye. And he said, oh, that's just Freddie. And he says, a lot of the ladies have problems with that. And you just have to yell at Freddie and he'll let it open up. And I'm like, that's exactly what I did.
Freddie, stay out of the women's room.
Yeah, seriously. But of course, it was Freddie's house before it was a women's room. So, you know, that's that kind of stuff that happens. So, but I like those experiences. I like them because they take you unaware. They are organic. I'm not hunting for something. And, you know, I'm always really cautious when I'm ghost hunting to really scrutinize everything I see or feel or hear, because you know that you're in that setting for that reason. It's one of the reasons when we ghost hunt that I don't tell people that come with me what's going on in the house. They'll be predisposed to expect it and anticipate it.
Yeah, which is why whenever we do these episodes, I don't want to know what the topic is beforehand.
Yeah, for those who don't realize it, literally, Stu never knows a single thing until the minute I say, so tonight, Stu, we're going to talk about blah, blah, blah. Because he doesn't want to know. It ruins the spontaneity.
Mm-hmm. True.
So, yeah, it's just really interesting. If you don't tell the people that are going with you, your team, what's going on, and then these things happen. And I always ask the homeowners to stay in the house. I know in a lot of these TV shows, they're like, give us 48 hours in your house. And I'm like, why? Why? This is their home. I want them to be here. I want them to know what's going on. I want them to see that nothing has occurred so that I'm telling them or I'm rigging something or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I always ask that I won't do a home or a business unless the family or whoever it is that owns it is there. And they're with me the whole time. They see what I see. They hear what I hear the whole time. And I want it that way. But it's really cool whenever like somebody in your team comes in and they're like, they don't usually just shout stuff out, because again, we don't want to predispose the rest of the team now that something happened in this area. And frankly, ghost hunters are like a bunch of chickens. As soon as they see something's going on in an area, they're like, boom, over to that area, all of them. So I don't want that either.
Like elementary school kids playing soccer. Wherever the ball is, there's a cluster of kids right around the ball.
So I don't want that. I'm going to rotate them at a certain interval, and I want to see if the next team catches the same experience. But they can write it down and slide it to me on a sheet of paper. And that way, we have a record that at 7:46 this happened. And then if the next team or the team after that at 1 o'clock in the morning has a similar experience, well, we can compare them. And compare them without prejudice, because they've written down what their experience was and never said a word. And the other person writes it down. So we can definitely see if it's a similar thing. And, you know, that's the beauty of trying to do it that way. But, and I have to tell you, one of my best experiences with that, and this was recorded. We went to Ryan Research Center in Durham, North Carolina, invited me years and years and years ago to be one of 10 groups to present ghost hunting to them. Now, Ryan is famous for working with psychical research and what have you. J.B. Ryan did do some work with ghosts and paranormal, but the problem with the ghosts and paranormal for a research center is that you can't make them work on demand, and you can't like bring them to your office, or you can invite Uri Geller to come to the office or whoever it is. You can't do that with ghosts. They just happen when they happen, and they happen where they happen. So that was one of the reasons it had never been a focus. And the shows were just beginning at that point. So they picked 10 groups from around the country. I don't know what their criteria was. I only know I was one of them. One of the very first group, actually, I was the very first group that they saw. And invited us to come down. And they gave a list of possible places, because they actually wanted to see you ghost hunt in action. And everybody wanted to do this old swampy cemetery, which to me sounded like the worst idea on the planet. Well, like the people at Ryan wanted to do it, and they thought it was very atmospheric and, you know, ethereal and all that. And I'm betting it was. I'm not arguing that point.
All that and more.
Yes. But on the other hand, I have one shot at showing you this, and I don't want all those external factors of the outside to be a part of the problem. You know, if you're ghost hunting outside and there's crickets going, it screws with your EVP. If it rains, you're done. You know, there's just 1,000 things that you're going to have to deal with that in an enclosed space you have better control over. So we ended up doing the North Carolina State Capitol building. And became good friends with a gentleman who's still my friend to this day, Ray Beck. He was the state historian at the time. And on about the third visit down to North Carolina, because Ray got fascinated and he decided to invite us to come down every so often. So about almost every year for quite a while, we would go down and ghost hunt for a weekend at the state capitol building, and Ray would host us. And one night, Ray is on the main stairs with a friend of his, her name was Betsy, and one of my team. And they were talking. Now, I knew the stories about this scream, that this phantom scream. There's been governors who've heard it. The security staff have heard it. Other people have heard it in the middle of the night or late in the evening. Somebody's still there working. And all of a sudden, you hear this horrible, like somebody's falling down a set of steps, right? And there is actually a story that goes with it, that a particular person tumbled down a set of stairs during Reconstruction era and broke his neck, the foot of the steps. It's a long set of steps. It goes up 4 stories. Ooh. So, you know, it would definitely be a deadly set of steps. So anyhow, my person standing there talking to Ray and Betsy, and the building is built with a central area and then 2 wings off of it. So I have a team in each wing, one on the third floor in the central area, and I'm in the conference room on the first floor with another person, and we're working EVP. So basically what happened on a site is you would get EVP and somebody would put it into the computer, secure it, save it, listen to it a couple times, write down what they thought it might be saying. and we do that process so we don't lose it, because EVP can fade away. And it's bizarre, like you've got it on tape or on the recorder and then it'll just vanish. So in order to not lose any of it, we downloaded it right away. And so that's what I'm working on. And all of a sudden, I hear this horrendous scream. And my first thought was not ghosts or dead people. I'm like, oh my God, somebody fell down the stairs.
Right, right.
And I go tearing out of the conference room, down the hallway, and I hear people thundering down the stairs from the top, the central area. People are running up towards me from both wings, and they're all screaming, who fell? Who fell? And we're sure we're going to find somebody with a broken leg or something at the foot of the stairs. God, please never let it be worse than that. Mm-hmm. And we get to the center of the stairs, and there stands my person, Ray and Betsy, and they're looking at us all like we're insane. And we're like, is everybody okay? And they're like, we're fine. What's wrong with you? And we're like, do you didn't hear that scream? No, we didn't hear any scream. How could you not have heard that scream? It came from this area. And you're like, no, we didn't hear anything. Fortunately, all three of the teams had recorders running at that time. They all caught the scream, and the people standing where the scream happened never heard it.
Interesting. Yeah.
That is interesting. I thought that was.
I thought you were going to say that they heard it and they were like, yeah, yeah, it's just the scream, like, you know, like the ghost that cried wolf. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was really odd because they were right there where it happened. Like you can tell from the distance on the different recorders,
right?
That it was, you know, it wasn't at the far end of the building. It was
where you could locate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they heard nothing. All three of them looked completely bewildered. And then I said, roll the tapes back. Let's see what we can catch. And they all stepped away, listened to their tapes, brought them back, and they're like, here it is. It was fascinating. And, you know, I just found it really interesting. And I've seen those kind of things. But you have to use a real common sense approach to ghost hunting. You really do. In order to get those kind of results, you have to stay calm. Nobody heard anything else. We weren't thinking ghosts. And I always tell everybody, by the time my head rolls around to the word ghost, everything's all over with, because whenever I see or hear something, most of the time it's okay, what are the lighting angles? What's going on outside? You know, I'm trying to figure it all out from a realistic standpoint first. Mm-hmm. We were in an old hotel in the Hollidaysburg area that's a restaurant now.
Been there.
And, yep. Mm-hmm. And we were on the second floor. We had taken a camera to the top of the third floor, which is an area that was not used at that time at all. I had some old furniture in it. And we had literally slaved this camera to the top of the stairs. It's an enclosed staircase. And I loved that because that helps to mitigate the idea of shadows moving and all this other stuff, because it's all built in. It's like a cracker box, kind of, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we had had people see, and there was always this sense of a dark presence on that staircase. So it would come out of the room on the second floor and go up the staircase. And I had felt it many times, but I had never caught it. So we get the bright idea to put this camera shooting in infrared at the top of the stairs. We literally lashed it down with duct tape because we were afraid it would be bumped or kicked or broken, and they can do that stuff. And we all went downstairs. We decided to work the first floor for a while. When we came back up to the second floor, I identified every single person. And when I watched the tapes later, and there's nothing that to me that ever is better than literally having to sit there and watch those 8 hours or whatever of tape. I know it's a pain in the butt. I get it. It takes 3 days to do it because you're focused. You'll lose focus after a while and you have to stop. But I saw this figure. He starts on the third. I just feel it was male. And he starts on the third step up from the bottom. He just appears out of the wall. And he walks up. Third step, fourth step, fifth step, sixth step, and then he just is gone. Black as night, completely full. It was a entity with apparently pants on because you could see the separation between the legs. And I have no clue what he was, who he was for sure, or what he was, but he was fascinating. I must have ran it back and watched it 20 times before I called anybody and said, I think I need other eyes on this. Because it is amazing to see something appear out of nowhere. It literally walked out of the wall, onto that third step, and then moved up, and then back into the wall.
It would be interesting to know if there were, if the architecture had changed, because if I recall, didn't that catch fire not once, but twice?
So there's where history is really important. So there was, the original hotel was actually across the alley from the one that sits there now, okay? And I could never figure, so I think there's a cluster of like five houses right there beside it. So as you're, it's right beside it on the same side of the street. So I could never figure out that the ghost stories didn't make sense within the context of the hotel. And obviously hotels are transient places, that makes it a little more difficult, but I literally scoured the newspaper for any mention of this particular structure. And there was a gentleman who owns a plumbing place in Hollidaysburg, an older gentleman. His dad had bought the archives, it's called the paper morgue, from the old Hollidaysburg newspaper. It's called, I think it was the Altoona Tribune, but I'm not sure if that's the name of it. I'd have to look it up. Anyway, he had all of them. And he had heard the stories from my book and me telling them and me talking on radios and crap like that. And he took the time, God love him, to go through these old newspapers and he unearthed the mystery.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So basically what happened is the original hotel did catch fire. Nobody died in it. Because see, all the stories I was being told is, oh, these are people who died in the fire. But none of that made sense. And when he found the story, it says that nobody died in the fire. So then the people that were working with me at the time, they got these elaborate, you know, ideas. They're like, well, it's because they owned a newspaper in town, and they did own the same people, you know, the same area. It was the same businessmen owned the paper. So they hid it. And I'm like, well, you'd be kind of hard pressed to hide three dead bodies coming out of a hotel.
Yeah. And you think, like, the coroner would have something to say about that, too. But
you know, and it just, you know, it would have been just been a part of the tragedy of the place burning down. And I'm sure the reporter would have said something along the lines, unfortunately, three lives were lost or whatever, you know, and leave it at that. So that put me on a whole different path. And this is why history is so important to a paranormal investigation. So then I come to find out that what happened is the hotel was burned, but it wasn't significant enough to destroy the entire, it wasn't burned to the ground. So there was a lot of good material left. So what he did is he took the material and built five houses, the five houses that sit over there in the corner. And then he bought the other lot where it sits today. So then I had to go find out what that lot was. It was the original police station, jail, and they used, there's a, in Hollidaysburg, there's the underground tunnels that were used either for smuggling, you know, all different, there's all kinds of different theories on what they were used for. And that area was used to house the horses, that tunnel opening for the, in the winter months. It was warmer, so they put the horses down there for the police. But it was a jail. So this makes a whole lot more sense. So then they built this building, and it was a two-story building, this hotel. And then years later, another hotel in town builds a three-story hotel and advertises it as the only three-story hotel in Hollidaysburg. So it angers the guy who has the hotel that we're talking about, and he adds a third floor. So everything was wrong in the history. So what I'm looking for is stories that have something to do with this prison / police station and tourism, but only in the late 1800s. And then all of a sudden, the thing started to make sense to me. This is a completely different building. Everything about the history of the hotel was wrong. It was mythically enhanced. People made these great big leaps and suppositions, you know, like they heard that the hotel had burned down. So, oh my God, people must have died in the hotel. There's this, you know, blah, blah, blah going on. And it's all because of this fire and, you know, and all this stuff. And really, the history of the hotel is completely different. It was, second floor was used at one point as a brothel. It was used as a place during World War II to help educate soldiers. It had a whole different history. So knowing your history is really important.
That's where you are way better than I am, because I'm just, history is one of those things that, you know, if it's older than 5 years and I haven't used it, I don't have much use for it.
Yeah. See, history to me is like, it's a treasure hunt, because everything can change by one piece of history.
And I'm perfectly happy to hear you talk about history, but am I going to seek it out myself? No, that's just not who I am. But, you know, I will listen to you talk about it until the cows come home.
But that's what makes the stories real. You know, the difference between a good ghost story and just a vignette is, so-and-so house is haunted. They say that this lady in gray walks down the stairs sometimes. Well, then my head goes to, well, who's the lady in gray? What happened to her there? Why is she still here? And then I want to fill in all those blanks, and that's the story. So that's why it's so important to get your history down. Sometimes it'll make all the difference in the world between telling the truth and a lie. And my stories are all nonfiction, and my publisher has people fact check me. So I try really hard to get my history straight.
Yeah. So did you ever find out then, what was there a different part of the architecture where there was like only just half a set of stairs or something there where the figure went up?
We know that at one point, that would have been the roof, so it would have been able to just walk. Now, it could have been during the time it was a jail. This is going back into the late 1700s, that there was something there. We have not been able to find any kind of architectural drawings or anything to give us that piece of information, but it did make me understand that I was looking at the wrong set of history. And, you know, like I said, it would have been a roof at that point in time. So they could have had storage up there. There could have been an attic in that area. We don't know what was there when it was a prison. It had to have at least 2 to 3 stories. Because usually how they were laid out is the first story was the courthouse or the police office. The second story would have been where the prisoners would have been kept. And then the third story was usually clerical. And storage and that kind of stuff. So that you see that similarly in a lot of the older courthouses and the older areas where there were jails at that time. And so that would be at least a reasonable assumption. So there very well could have been a set of steps up there at that time.
And you didn't think to ask?
Oh, honey, we've asked lots of things in that building. But that whatever that dark entity is, it was aggressive. It was always like angry. It would say, you know, get out of here. I'll shove you down the stairs, stuff like that. It didn't want to talk to you. So it wouldn't answer like those kind of questions. But if you'd ask it a question, you'd always get a hateful answer back.
Okay. So when you said dark, not only in color or, you know, yeah, but also in temperament.
Disposition. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. He was very upsetting. And I've had people run out of the second floor. We had a girl one time who came as a guest of one of our members, and I literally had to stop her from falling down the stairs onto the first floor because she was screaming. And I kept saying, what did you see? What did you see? What did you see? And it was the very first time we ever did the building. And she was hysterical. She was, you know, very young and like early 20s, and her eyes are wide, her mouth's going, but no sound's coming out, and just the screams, and she's shaking, and she's like, let me go, and she's screaming, and I'm like, okay, just walk down the stairs, I'll stand here to keep you safe, just please don't fall. And she gets down the stairs, that person goes, that was her friend, went down after her to see if she was okay, and I turned to my, because I always have teams, and there's at least 2 people, my partner for the evening, and I said, let's go. So I wanted to go see what she saw. So we ran down the hallway, stopped in the doorway to the second floor to that room, which becomes the central room in this haunting. And it's like a crossover room between the two sides. It's a bedroom. And both of us saw something and hit that doorway and just stopped. And I remember looking at it. And I looked out the window and I looked back and it was still there. And I looked out the window and I looked back at this guy and his eyes were as big as silver dollars. And I said, "Did you see something?" And he said, "Yes." And he started to open his mouth and I said, "Stop. Go downstairs, write it down." And I went down and I wrote it down. And we both saw the same thing. Mm-hmm. So what we saw was superimposed over the area where there was a bed, was a different bed we saw. And it was an older bed with a higher headboard. It was brass, iron, something like that. And there was a girl in the bed. She had chestnut hair. She was young, late teens, early 20s. And there was a blanket. It was tan. It had a red, or blue, excuse me, a yellow and a green stripe. And she was obviously dead. There was blood all over. And we both saw it at the same time, froze, and neither of us said another word till we went down, went to separate rooms, actually, and wrote it down, read it over, made our corrections to make sure we had all our details in there, and then handed it to the other person. So that there was something very dark in that building.
Yeah. Anytime I've been in there has been in the restaurant part only on the, on the ground.
It has stories for that part, but not nearly as dark. That it's weird. Like when you cross this, when you go up the stairs to the second floor, the previous owners, I don't know a thing about the owners currently, but the previous owners had the same experience. They all told me that you would hear like laughter downstairs. You would hear sounds of people talking, almost like there's a party going on, that kind of stuff on the first floor. But once you got to the top of the stairs, the air was completely different. It was like every hair on your body would stand up and you would know you have just entered a completely different area. And the second floor was the most haunted of the floors. The third floor, there was some activity, but not a ton of it, not as much as the second floor.
Which would make sense if that was a newer part of the building. Yeah,
the second floor was definitely the most active, and it was also the darkest. Like, there were a lot of people who would get really creeped out. And, like, I wouldn't tell anybody that. I took some tours through there, and they came to hear me tell stories downstairs and have dinner. And then we were just going to tour the whole building and tell some history. And I can't tell you the number of times we'd hit that doorway to that room, and a person or two would just, like, freeze up and I'd say, "Are you okay?" And they're like, I don't want to go into that part of the building. And I'm like, "Okay, it's fine. You want to wait here? I'd rather wait downstairs for you. Could you just come to the steps and call me when you're done?" "Sure. We'll go up to the third floor then." And then they would tell me that they just felt really like they cannot walk into that room, that something horrible happened and they didn't want to know what was in that room. So it was quite an interesting building to do. But I thought, that we haven't really talked as much about ghosts as I usually do. And I just wanted to tell a little bit about what it's like to be a ghost hunter and how I got to the place where I got to be the ghost lady and the paranormalist and all of that. It's almost 25 years now of ghost hunting and a lot of experiences. I could tell stories till the cows come home, but it's a fascinating world. I've probably changed my perspective and my mind 100 times over those years, because every time something new happens, you have to factor that in. That's how it's supposed to work, where if you're looking at it from a scientific standpoint and a historical standpoint and a rational standpoint, then you have to be willing to never make any assumptions. It's gotten me in trouble. I actually refused to fake stuff for a TV show one time, well before there were any of the other TV shows out there, and it probably cost me a fortune, but I wasn't willing to go that route because I really seriously wanted to know the truth.
Well, you can't put a price on integrity.
No, you can't. And I got
evidently you can, because some people sold their integrity for a specific number.
But I'm just saying, that I really have wanted to understand this from every angle. And truly understand it. And at the end of the day, for me, it's not even about the EVP. It's not about all the cool experiences. I love all of that. I do. And I always have. But what it really works out to at the very end of the day is the very first experience I ever had, which was helping somebody who was in a really bad position and needed help. And those are still the cases that I work to this day. I don't do a whole lot of let's just go out and ghost hunt for fun anymore, partly because the pandemic and the economy has changed. And now anybody that has a haunted house thinks that they are about to become Rockefeller from it. You know, whenever you can charge $1,200 for somebody to spend a night in one of your old abandoned buildings to ghost hunt, that's just a little too much. I get it. I get it's what the market will bear. Not mad. I believe in capitalism. It's just too much. So the cases I focus on are usually private homes, people who are hurting, even spirits that are hurting. You know, rescuing and helping people doesn't just mean living people. It means dead people. So if there's somebody confused and lost and hasn't been able to figure out how to go where they're supposed to be going, will help with that too. And to me, that's the whole meaning behind ghost hunting. It's not really hunting, it's soul rescue. It's helping people to cope with what is, whether it's you're living with a ghost or you are the ghost. And that's where it ends for me. So I guess that's where I'm done.
Okay. Well, since at the beginning of this episode, I did the stuff I normally say now, then I'm speechless.
They should know how much we talk after an episode and before.
You know, and it's one of those things where neither you or I are in this for the money. I mean, that's why these things are free. There's no ads that come up. If we ever did do something like that, it might be interesting to take the parts before and after and carefully assemble them, you know, because, you know, you and I talk about several different things. Just a thought, but that's going, you know, the Q&A comes first.
Yeah. So guys, if you want to hear this other stuff, you got to send him some questions. Come on. they have no clue because you don't talk a whole lot on the episodes that, you know, you have these wonderful stories and this great perspective and you've done some ghost hunting yourself and you have this really scientific mind that looks at it from, you know, an interesting perspective. And I hope that over the course of time, you'll share more of that because you are truly a fascinating person. And I find you to be a dear friend. And it's always a pleasure to share history and hauntings and just life. We talk about our families and we talk about all kinds of stuff. And it's always a lot of fun.
It is.
So I hope you'll do that too.
Alrighty, so with that, I think I'm going to say, looking out, I actually had to close the curtains because I didn't want too much of the outside, even though it's overcast today, I didn't want too much of that light coming in. I like my LED lighting.
So, I'm the opposite. I'm all natural light.
If I want natural, I'm going to be outside. I'm going to be outside enjoying it. And you know, if I'm indoors, then for me, I want indoor lighting.
I have a dear friend who lives on the Chesapeake, and he has the most amazing house. Like from about waist high, the whole half of the house that faces the Chesapeake is nothing but windows. So
he shouldn't. Gorgeous. He shouldn't throw stones.
No, but it's absolutely gorgeous, and it's the most beautiful natural lighting. I mean, it's amazing. I love to sit at their house and, you know, and just look out at the river, at the water. It's really cool. They have water taxis and, everybody has a pier and really the front of the house is faced the water. They don't face the roads.
Cool. Yeah, even so, I think both Mrs. Stu and I would say, I'm not cleaning those.
Well, I've never had to clean them, but I have to say I've enjoyed them many times.
Anyway, with that, I think I will say good afternoon.
Same to you, my friend.